listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Episode 265 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
And this week we are joined by guest JP Bradley, who has helped work on a one-shot for the tabletop RPG role-playing game, Spire, The City Must Fall. One-shot series is called Shadow Operations. JP, say hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for actually agreeing to be on this madness. We've been told that it's JP's first ever podcast, so it's cool, but we'll try to be easy. Take it easy, you know. I'm not making any guarantees. You've already had tech issues, so that's great.
That's kind of
I've been assured that I'm in good hands.
Yep. I mean, and we've actually also, through, you know, loveliness, we've now got three Pauls on the episode because JP's middle name is Paul, so... it's like I collect pulls in my life.
It's like with Pokemon or something. You kind of trap us in like these little balls, then use us to battle like gyms or Timothy's or...
Or like contemporary geek issues.
Yeah, all that.
Yeah.
Does that mean we're all at the same evolutionary stage or...
Unsure.
What is the evolution of a pull?
As possible.
I've got to be one more right though, because it's John Paul.
Yeah.
So if you keep going, if you rub a moonstone against yourself, maybe you can become a John Paul too.
Why a moonstone? That's not my worst pressing question. Why a moonstone?
It's literally the only thing I can remember from Pokemon. I haven't played since Pokemon Yellow.
Oh, okay, that's fair.
I'm gonna be the very best.
What was the anime news? That the anime's still going. That's the important thing to remember there, let alone the games.
Is Ash drawing his poker pension?
Not yet. I mean, he's only like a couple of years younger than us, and yet he's perpetually, what, 10?
Well, I mean, this is kind of Cartoon like World logic. So,
I hate
cartoons never age, apparently.
It's not quite as bad as The Simpsons, because I think I saw someone say that in the Bart and Lisa were on the cusp of being Gen Xers, which is just, what the hell?
Yeah, they are.
That's just wrong.
I suppose I better get us on topic. Okay, so as we said in the introduction, JP has helped work on a one-shot for the role-playing series Spire, The City Must Fall. JP, importantly for our listeners, I suppose we kind of need to know what the heck is Spire, The City Must Fall.
Okay, so Spire is a narrative role-playing game of a dark elf insurrection in an impossibly large city called Spire. A couple of hundred years ago, Spire was taken over by the almost comically villainous High Elves, who took over, booted everybody out, and now dark elves can only live there if they do a 2 to 4 year durance. Like kind of a terrible gap year where they get paid terribly in order to get citizenship so they can actually live in Spire itself. And the players are people who've done their durance, who live inside the city, but have joined a secret and illegal ministry of this kind of renegade god called Our Hidden Mistress. And they have got one goal, which is basically to boot out the High Elves and to take Spire back for the Dark Elves. And kind of the rough kind of pitch is it's kind of Necromunda meets Gormenghast meets some of the kind of Watch novels from Discworld. It's kind of both very dark and very comic and kind of somewhere in the middle. The players are all running around making an absolute mess of things.
I like. This is why I decided to pick up the book. And I was like, wait, JP said he was doing this one shot. Wait, that one shot... Basically, things escalated a few weeks ago and I bought stuff. At some point, I'm going to play Spire, the city must fall, with my regular DM group. That's my plan.
That's your plan?
That's my plan. D&D group. Yeah. Let's do that. Let's do that instead of regular D&D. Yeah, it's fine. We'll overthrow the sea. We'll overthrow those high elves. No worry.
I mean, I am quite biased, obviously, because I wrote for it. But it is an absolutely cracking game. It is. It's kind of the core mechanic in it is the kind of stress fallout system. So every single time you take an action, unlike D&D, like the bad guys aren't moving against you, but every time you take an action, it has the risk of going wrong. And then you take stress, and you keep taking stress until kind of you keep rolling against it. And the more stress you have, the more chance you have of rolling below it. And when you roll below it, it all comes home to roost in the form of fallout. So that can be, say, if you're in a fight, you might break your arm, for example. If you are trying to get somebody's services and you're kind of trying to pay them off, you could end up in debt to them to the point at which they can own you and turn you against yourself. There's lots of kind of ways that the kind of actions that the players can take can go very, very wrong very, very quickly. And it's just, it's quite challenging to run, but it is very exciting when everything starts to fall apart.
It reminds me a little bit of the the sort of sanity kind of situation in Call of Cthulhu, where if that there's that one score that if it, the higher it goes, like the more the it's like the it, rather than health, it's that main core mechanic. Mm.
Is it rather Although there is health,
there is health as well, but there's that other one which is like you see where you basically slowly go mad. It's been a few months since I played it, and it was the first time I played it, so forgive me if I can't remember the name.
This is all sounding very 2020 to me.
I mean,
have to admit,
well, with the sanity issue,
insanity and just having to deal with stress and more things going wrong, and
So, JP, what's the one shot you wrote for it? It's part of a series of one shots that became available for their game, isn't it?
Yes, basically, what we were seeing on kind of the Rome, Rook and Deco Discord was a lot of people coming along and going, I really like Spire, I really want to run it for people, what's the best kind of scenario to do for a one-shot? Well, they've had campaign frames out there, which are kind of more extended things, but they haven't had dedicated one-shots to help people kind of get into the game. So Grant Howitt and Christopher Taylor, who are the two guys at Rome, Rook and Deco who wrote it, basically said, we want to do one-shots and we want to bring a bunch of people on board in order to write them. And I was very fortunate in that I'd just written kind of my own adventure for their follow-up game to Spire, which is called Heart, which is all about dungeon delving beneath the city. I'm not going to go into that right now because that is an entirely separate thing. But yeah, so I wrote an adventure for that and they were like, oh, you can actually write. So we'd like to have you kind of come on board and kind of take on this adventure. And the one that I got was an adventure called Powder Keg. Powder Keg is about two factions of knights from the North Docks. They're knights in the traditional sense, in that they carry around big swords and got big heavy plate armor, but they are also boisterous, beer-swilling gangsters who are sworn to knightly orders that all operate out of local pubs.
I'm listening.
You can play a knight in the game, and everything that you need to know about them is that all of their top-level advances are basically legendary quests / pub crawls. That is who they are. So you've got these two sets of knights that basically are effectively neighbours. They both have pubs at either end of this bridge. And for whatever reason, the two of them are not getting along, but they're both allies of the ministry. And the ministry needs them, or at least the kind of strength of arms that the knights have got, for the upcoming revolution. So you have got one knight as a party to go in there and sort out the problem before they order in the police and everybody starts getting shot.
Hence the term, hence the name Powder Keg, because that's how tense the situation is from what I read for the guidelines for it. It's like super, super tense. Out of interest, because you said you obviously wrote that one campaign then for Heart, so what was the kind of process, JP, that you kind of went through to, like, to write the one shot? Like, were you given that scenario from the guys, or were they, or were you able to sort of pitch something?
For this one, because it was kind of it was the first time they were giving people quite so much license. They accepted pitches before for Strata, but for this one, because they had a very kind of specific idea for what they wanted out of it, there were set kind of scenarios, but they were kind of rough outlines, little more than kind of a title and a rough idea of what the problem was. And then we kind of, me and the other writers involved, and, you know, there's people like Jason Pitchy and Christine Beard and Sharang Biswas, we were all kind of given license to go in, take the kind of bones of the bones of the problem, really, and kind of turn it into a little kind of setting with whatever they needed in order to kind of make the story work. So everything from kind of props and who the NPCs are, I got to do. Kind of when I got hold of Powder Keg, I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do with it. So I just kind of started writing in the vague hope that the idea would come to me. And kind of the idea of these knights as kind of neighbours, and the fact that it all had to be kind of settled in one night, meant that I kind of wanted them to be close together, which made the kind of made it kind of like a drawn battle lines between them. So yeah. Kind of once I kind of got that pinned down, I knew that kind of I needed to work through not what the problem was between them, because actually the quarrel between the two parties doesn't really matter that much. It's not what's important. But I needed to basically create NPCs on both sides that you could go around and that you could kind of have their own deals going on. So every single character that's in there has got something that they want that you can use to manipulate them. Because everything conspires about basically giving the players and giving the GM kind of various sticks that they can use to kind of beat the story into whatever shape they want. It's not about having... The entire setting is about having open questions, giving you plot hooks that you can basically turn around and go, well, this is how I want this story to end. That having been said, there is a suggested kind of ending, which I won't spoil. So yeah, so I just needed an antagonist just to pull it all tight at the end so that there was a definite resolution that would force the players to actually make a decision. Although usually by that time, they're usually so deep into things that, you know, everything's going to be falling apart anyway. But yeah, it was just about kind of finding a way to give players kind of enough tools that they could really make a mess of the situation. And that's basically how, what I think is the core element of any good kind of one shot. It's just cause trouble and let the players have at it.
That sounds like a fair assessment of that, yeah. So this sort of campaign, it's what, meant to be sort of played about, was it 3 to 4 hours? That was the case for what it said at the beginning of the book, wasn't it?
More or less, yeah. I mean, that again, that's kind of why we have that tie-off at the end. We have that kind of twist in most of the adventures that are in there, because you need something to bring it to a head, because if you just let players wander around, they can sometimes act like they've got all the time in the world.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at me?
No comment. So... any advice have you got sort of for people who are looking to, write a one-shot themselves, for, you know, be it for Spire or any other sort of role-playing games?
I mean, depending upon kind of your game, the kind of core tenets are start and media res. Don't have them meet in the tavern and have to go through introducing each other. Give them a reason why they all know each other. Get that kind of stuff out of the way. Kind of, as a GM, don't be afraid to front-load your session by saying, tonight you are robbing a bank, tonight you are breaking into this place, tonight you are rescuing this prisoner from this dungeon. Because kind of setting expectations early is probably one of the surest ways of kind of getting your players kind of focused and on point with what they're doing. Then, when you're kind of designing it, as a general rule, give them one objective, preferably something that they can't just kill. If they have to steal something, if they have to rescue somebody, especially if it's something big or somebody who doesn't want to be rescued, that's always quite entertaining because it gives them kind of a problem that they have to wrestle with when they actually get to the objective. And then all you generally need to do is just put one kind of roadblock between them and kind of their objective. So if they've got to, like, go somewhere and steal something, put it in the middle of a party that's got guards on the door. Any way that they decide to get past it is entirely valid, but generally players will create their own problems as they kind of do it. And just listen to them as they're kind of going through it, because there'll be some of them that kind of want to go sneakily, there'll be some of them that want to burst in, there'll be somebody who inevitably wants to hide in a barrel or something. You know, just say yes to them, but then kind of look for opportunities where you can kind of go, well, this was a bad idea, so let's make it a little bit more difficult. So, like, the guards catch them, or their forged papers aren't quite as good as they hoped. Things like that. And generally, what you'll find is that by the time they've navigated one obstacle and actually tried to get to the objective, generally you're going to be starting to push about 2.5-3 hours anyway. At that point, you can just have an antagonist is generally a good idea, or have some way of kind of tying off that story. I like antagonists because they can turn up, and as a GM, I get to monologue and do a real sneery voice as I go, "Aha, you fell into my plan, you blundering fools." And that generally, it works quite well because it upsets my players and makes them want to hurt this person. But also, it lets me do a silly voice, and quite frankly, you know, I've got to make my own fun. But yeah, just generally, just have an escape plan. Don't overthink how many problems you're going to put in the way, because players will just create their own for you. And just say yes to them when they come up with an idea. Inevitably, it will be something that they haven't thought through entirely.
Yeah, we've found that we've got people making things complicated on a D&D campaign that Paul's running at the moment. We're essentially doing the equivalent of a bank heist. And yeah, just making their own problems again and again. And I'm trying not to be one of the players that keeps making problems.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It just kind of adds like an element that, you know, you kind of have to tackle.
Our current heist plan has so many moving parts. It could go very horribly wrong.
Without giving too much away, it was originally meant to be a case of them going into the bank, kind of doing some basic, you know, kind of puzzles. Don't give it away. But yeah, it's kind of fairly simple, and they've complicated it to the point where it's like
there are so many points of failure.
This is kind of fun. And because they've actually started sticking in those plans, I feel like it'll be a bad decision to go back to my original plan, where, like, all of their efforts for the past two three sessions have been almost for naught. So you kind of have to kind of, you know, allow them to get over the obstacles that they've created.
So you've had to replan your plan.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's always worth doing, because the thing about that is whenever a player complicates something, it's because they are kind of tacitly telling you that they want to do things a certain way. So if they want to hide in a barrel and be taken in by, like, the servants, at some point they kind of want to get caught. And kind of responding to that and kind of letting them have the adventure that they're having in their head, I think really kind of deepens kind of their appreciation for it. And also it means that you can prep less stuff, because... like I say, like you've said, you like prepped a whole bunch of stuff that they're not going to see because they've gone off in a completely different direction. Frankly, you could have just said it's in the fall and prepped absolutely nothing and just waited for them to come up with a plan by themselves and then prep for that.
I mean, to be fair, there's still a lot of the prep that I've done that is still kind of you know, ready to be sprung, as it were. It's just...
Paul has to be careful of what he says, because I'm part one of the players.
Exactly, exactly.
And there's a chance they might also, the rest of them might listen to this podcast. The off chance. But yeah, so, JP, like, obviously, it sounds like you regularly play role-playing games. Have you got, like, a regular group or groups that you tend to play with, and have you guys been managing to play during lockdown? Okay.
Actually, lockdown has greatly improved the attendance at our games. Kind of before lockdown, we were all doing different things, and it was occasionally quite difficult to kind of get a group together. But yeah, we've currently got two games going on. We're playing, my friend is running Curse of Strafforus,
which is Dungeons and
which
Dragons.
It is Dungeons and Dragons. It is Dungeons and Dragons horror setting. We're off to Ravenloft to go hunt a vampire. We've fought Strahd twice. We are only level 4. He has beaten my character into the ground twice, and also bit him. Yeah, it's not going terribly well for us, especially because we apparently are too stupid to run away from a fight, but it is very funny. We're kind of tottering through that. And also I'm running Heart, which, as I kind of mentioned earlier, is the sequel to Spire. Basically, at the center of Spire and in the ground beneath it is the Heart, where the impossible size of the city above has kind of curdled reality. So you've got this kind of weird place where reality starts to break down, and you're all playing people who are delving into it, which has got interesting classes like I am a train knight, or I am a witch who occasionally turns into a zoetrope horror that kind of scuttles like Sadako across the ground, horrifying people. So yeah, that's kind of that's our other game, and I'm kind of really excited to be running that because it takes all of the weirdness out of Spire and just cranks it up to 11.
Oh my god.
Weird is good.
Yeah. Out of interest, like, what's the tech setup you guys have been using to play whilst this has been going on then?
Yeah, we've been using just a Discord server and a bunch of mics. Some of us, like, a couple of people in a room, or kind of in mine and my partner's case, each of us in our office ignoring our cat, who is just furious at not being allowed in.
Team
yeah.
cat.
Yeah, we've been using, as it, Skype a bit.
Yeah.
And a bit of Roll20. Not that I think we're moving away from Roll20.
I'm not entirely sure because cause I've been using Dungeon Fog over this past weekend to try and actually
get your maps.
Make the maps better. Mm. And I'm not 100% sure about using Dungeon Fog for the actual...
Well, no, because there was that other platform we were looking at that was like Roll20.
What, Astral?
Yeah, Astral.
Yeah, Astral looks really interesting. It kind of... One of the reasons, because we're still using Roll20 for Curse of Strahd and actually for Heart, just because we can actually... I've been using a Google extension called Beyond 20 that actually links Roll20 into D&D Beyond. So we've actually got characters constructed there for our campaign, and then you can actually just... it will macro automatically when we kind of click our attacks. It'll roll an attack on Roll20 for us and show us the damage, like it was a macro done off a character sheet there. So that's been quite useful for Curse of Strahd. It's less useful for Heart, but then Heart's not a game that is heavily dependent on maps anyway. Although it does have kind of the big world map, which is basically what I'm using it for, and kind of rolling dice together. But yeah, kind of Astral's looking like a possibly interesting option. It definitely, the kind of demo I saw of it was very pretty. It was all dynamic lighting and animated GIFs of torches and stuff. So I'm kind of interested to see if that's a viable alternative.
I think one of our biggest annoyances with Roll20, but it might be the case of anything, is just that trying to get even sound to work consistently when you're in something like Roll20, we found that we can't get people's audio to stay consistent. Like, people will get cut out after a while or something, and they'll have to refresh being in the session and stuff. I mean, is that something you guys have had?
We're running our sound through the Discord.
Is that because you found Roll20 unreliable, or you just went for Discord as default?
This was kind of my friend's decision. Yeah. I think they were having kind of difficulty with it.
Yeah.
I do know that we had to mute Roll20 because we were actually getting feedback because it recorded both. It was broadcasted through Roll20 and through Discord at the same time, and we were getting some terrible echo. So we've been using Discord, and we've been using, I'm trying to remember the name of it. There's basically a kind of music bot on there that we've been using as well to kind of do ambient background noise. And that's been quite good.
Maybe we should, because if I'm having to be on your PC anyway, we don't have to use my Discord profile anyway. We're just thinking, strategizing of that, because we still haven't quite found like that comfortable online play experience whilst everything's been going on. Like we've gotten through sessions, but we went through the same D&D campaign that you guys have, the Curse of the Strahd. Our group has done that, but it was painful finishing off because we started it before lockdown and then finished it
during lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is good to know. Going back to Spire, out of interest, would you say that there's maybe some social and cultural dynamics in the game that have kind of real-world parallels with past and ongoing issues with oppression and colonialism? Or is that just me?
Yeah, you clearly picked up on that very subtle kind of commentary that's going on.
it's welcome. I mean, subtle perhaps isn't the word I might use, but then I'm kind of biased in this regard because I've done study stuff like post-colonial theory and that. So, but it was that like a big driver for kind of constructing the world, you know?
I mean, I'd have to kind of defer to Grant and Chris on this, but I pretty much consumed everything about Spire, including there's like a director's commentary for Kickstarter backers where they kind of go through the process of how they came up with kind of each domain, which is kind of how they've broken down districts. And there's definitely kind of a focus on the kind of the colonial power and the oppression and the kind of the high elves and the way that they can act towards the drought and towards kind of other denizens of Spire.
I'm just checking though, there's no politics in this, right?
Absolutely no whatsoever.
Good, because so long as it's given a slightly different name, it doesn't count as no politics.
There is as much politics in this as there is in an Ubisoft game. I think kind of there's very specific kind of ways that they've discussed the dynamics, though, because there's certain things that exist in the setting that are kind of backgrounded. So there is kind of there's a racial dynamic, obviously, between the High Elves and the Dark Elves, but it is something that's kind of backgrounded. And I think the reason for that is that Grant and Chris are both pale white guys from England who are not necessarily the people who kind of should be talking with authority on that subject. Kind of for their part, they have done the kind of work of bringing in kind of sensitivity readers and bringing in more kind of diverse voices to talk about kind of different parts and different kind of experiences of oppression.
Yeah.
I know kind of, trying to remember his name, Lawrence kind of wrote about kind of the oppression of disabilities in Strata. And there's a very kind of interesting thing where the kind of his adventure in that was about kind of protecting their home from the High Elves who wanted to tear it down. And so there's kind of an interesting thing about kind of eviction and basically taking people who the High Elves see as being effectively work shy or being useless to their purposes and kind of allowing you to play from their perspective. But that's something that Lawrence could do that Chris and Grant couldn't, that I couldn't. So I think there's kind of, I think definitely that kind of discussion of oppression and the kind of vectors that it inflicts itself upon the oppressed is ever present throughout Spire. But I think there's kind of there is a certain degree of knowing which lane you're in. So knowing who is the right person to bring on board to kind of discuss certain topics that not every writer necessarily can.
No, that it's nice to hear that they've actually done that, because I can imagine with a lot of sort of campaigns and systems that have been created in the past that those kind of discussions haven't happened. And obviously that becomes quite obvious. I mean, considering, oh God, what happened with White Wolf the other year with what was it? Was it Vampire the Masquerade that
it was 20th anniversary of Vampire the Masquerade, I think, or it was the new edition of it. Were they comparing like vampirism to the oppression of homosexuals in like Poland or something along that kind
they did it in a very untasteful way that was not helpful to oppressed groups, from what I remember. And that's pretty politely.
I think the kind of thing there as well was that they took a very real kind of... it was actually a real event that they basically lifted and kind of ported over into World of Darkness. And, yeah, that's definitely kind of... That's a no-no. It's... You can't take somebody's actual kind of lived oppression and use it basically as grist for the mill. There's kind of... This is when... What I'm talking about kind of background in certain things is we're talking obliquely about kind of the way that oppression works rather than necessarily saying this is actually somebody's lived experience. This is, you know, taking direct kind of inspiration from somebody who has been oppressed, because that's partly not our story to tell, but also it is incredibly gross to take something that, you know, somebody's kind of lived trauma and basically turn it into a game.
So I
definitely think kind of role-playing games have, have an ability to kind of let you take on or explore different kind of vectors of oppression.
Yeah.
But yeah, you definitely don't want to kind of be taking somebody's lived experience and kind of just gamifying it.
It's like, oh, that's some good material. I could use that. It's like, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah.
But no, that's fair. Thank you for answering that. And it kind of gels with what I've been suspecting as well, or sort of like thinking that needs to kind of happen with things like that. Because there is a lot of, it's like, not tabletop, but one of the games that was, I'm trying to think, and it's not even as overt, but one of the games that was previewed in the PS5 kind of like what would you call it, reveal stream that happened last week, and there was this one game that looked really cute, and then you had this representation of what looked like native type peoples that was quite culturally stereotyped, and it was like
I actually did a double take, because I was looking through the stream. I didn't watch it live. Because I thought, well, if there's something I don't care about, I want to be able to skip through it.
We made the mistake of watching it live, but yeah.
It's just not worth it with these things. But, you know, with that, it's like, what was that? I did see that.
Bringing it back to tabletop, I do think there's certainly with a lot of fantasy races, there can be some real stereotyping that kind of goes on. Mm. Like, orcs definitely get a raw deal, and half-orcs, in terms of representation.
I mean, that's kind of one of the things that 5th edition has kind of tried to do when it comes to kind of the different races, basically, because you've had... previously non-playable races that have just been literally enemies for you to kind of kill, and they've kind of started thinking about how those can actually be played rather than just being like fodder, which I kind of, you know, respect, or at least a little bit.
Yeah.
So, for example, was it Tieflings? I'm not sure whether those were in like 3.5 or anything like that.
I mean, Tieflings are an old, I think, second edition.
Okay.
But I don't know if they were sort of as... they weren't necessarily as widely available in 3.5. I don't remember it being an option when I was actually trying to do character creation all those many, many years ago.
No.
It might have been an add-on. But
kind of my... my kind of interaction with Tieflings from around about that era is I remember there's Anna the Tiefling from Planescape Torment, which is basically the only reason that I remember that they're in second edition.
That's fair.
There were a lot of games like that, which I think, you know, before the current trend of things like Critical Role, where it's, you know, people can kind of watch it and then think, oh, hang on, maybe we should do it as well. But yeah. For the longest time, outside the, getting dragged in by, you know, a geeky friend who was already, you know, equipped with everything, it was those on-the-shelf games for PC and, you know, some console stuff as well, which, you know, kind of, you know, introduced people to the, you know, this is something I could maybe look into.
Yeah, it's kind of, because I think kind of my introduction was probably the original Baldur's Gate, which, having gone back and tried to replay it, is a real slog to get through. I mostly got as far as I did. But there was kind of knowing less about D&D, with it being less accessible, there was something kind of slightly mystical about it. There's like, oh, I didn't quite understand the mechanics, I didn't quite understand the world, and kind of that possibility seemed really kind of appealing to me. But then also, I couldn't find the books to play it. And I was like 12, so I had no cash to do it anyway. But you know, whereas I think nowadays, with things like Critical Role and with kind of so many of these shows, and with kind of the internet, it's much more accessible to get into. And that's kind of a great thing, because people should be able to kind of get into the game easily.
If you take, for instance, the guys behind Spire, as you said, they kick-started the game, it sounds like. Couldn't have done that back in the day, but also they've now got, they've got their stuff online in a store that you can easily just buy either physical or download sort of PDFs of.
But I also want to point out that it's become so mainstream now that they've actually done charity events with celebrities playing D&D.
Yes, this is true.
You know, when you kind of see, what was it, Nish Kumar and whatnot, and, you know, even like Terry Crews, I think, is a, you know, kind of quite famous D&D player, and Vin Diesel, apparently, and stuff like that. And it's just like quite some big names there.
And of course, Vin Diesel. He was one of the, you know, the first, you know, what you would call big celebs to, you know, talk about it quite very happily. And that was always kind of nice, instead of, you know, and then, you find out now that there are all these celebs who were always kind of into it, but they just felt that they couldn't really, you know, say anything about it because it was just, you know, wrong audience.
I think when, like, the Guild was coming out still as like a new thing, like it wasn't quite, it hadn't quite reached kind of like mass velocity and impact at that point.
To be fair, that was more about massively multiplayer online games, so it's not quite kind of the same thing, but it was still in like that incredibly geeky kind of part of nerddom.
Oh, here's a question: who did D&D better, Big Bang Theory, Community, or Stranger Things?
Well, definitely not Big Bang Theory.
weirdly enough, I wasn't even considering Big Bang Theory.
Kind of half watched Stranger Things, so I didn't really get the full.
You were kind of like out of it at the time. It was post operation.
Was it?
Yeah, that was after.
Wait, you stuck on Stranger Things when I was coming out of an operation? What the fuck?
Hey, watch this. It's a nightmare world.
To be fair, you picked a book to borrow, which you didn't read, and you tried reading and gave of me, and you borrowed Nosferatu by Joe Hill from me for Waiting for Your
Oh, God.
So, you know, like, is it all my
life
fault?
Choices.
But yeah, I quite enjoyed it. I mean, Community's kind of version of D&D is obviously not kind of typical. I mean, for a start, like Abed was the one to roll all the dice, if I remember rightly. So,
but then again, that kind of makes sense if everyone doesn't have their own kit, but you don't want to go passing dice all the way around the table.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a shortcut to make sure that the players can still kind of do stuff, but without getting bogged down into the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of understandable in certain respects.
I think considering them, of the two that you mentioned, probably the most accurate would be Strange Things, and the most affectionate would be Community.
Yeah.
Mm.
Not that there wasn't, you know, any affection in, you know, Stranger Things, but I think they were kind of concentrating on trying to, you know, have it as a thing that they could refer to instead of,
yeah,
you know.
So, I mean, with Strange Things, it was more like things that the kids did, whereas with Community, it was actually the narrative of at least two episodes.
Was it two? It was definitely more than one, but was it two or was it three?
I think it was two.
It was two.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's been a while, though.
It has been a while. But, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I think... I'm just looking at my list of questions. I'm like, is there anything else I can fit in which JP isn't expecting? Just be like...
So,
Paul's got something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, what in terms of kind of, are you creating like any campaigns or any one shots at the moment?
I've got a current project that's kind of off the back of doing Powder Cake, actually. So I'm quite pleased by that because it means that it's not just a fluke. I can actually do this. So I've got something, but it is very early days.
Fair.
Not quite received the contract on it yet, so I can't talk about it yet. But it is something a little bit bigger, and it is kind of in the same milieu. I'm going to get to do a little bit of world building that I'm pretty excited about. I'm kind of looking forward to getting my teeth into that.
Nice. Retroid, do you have any questions for JP whilst we have his undivided attention?
Well, you see, I only played tabletop way back in school and a little bit in college, which was in the 80s.
Sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
It was a long time ago in the galaxy far. But yeah, it has been a long time, and for the longest time, I mean, you know, like most people in the 80s, I probably started off with the Choose Your Own Adventure books.
The classics.
Yeah. Now, is there anything? Now, I know that, you know, the focus is on tabletop, but obviously you've got far more of a knowledge of tabletop than, you know, I do. But is there anything that you wish would get in its breakout moment, either in a reference, in a TV series, or just something that would, you know, give it a bit of more of a kick up the ass to get it, you know,
more coverage
in more people's minds and in hands.
I mean, I think kind of what I'd like to see is possibly some more of the kind of indie RPGs getting a little bit of time in the limelight. There's a lot of focus on D&D because that's what people know culturally.
Well, that's the main thing, isn't it? It's a little bit like if someone says, "Oh yeah, I like 60s music," or that'll be the Beatles.
Yeah, it's like people saying they'll Google something. It's like D&D has become kind of shorthand for tabletop roleplay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are a lot of kind of things coming through from the indie scene that are really interesting. That are doing completely different takes on how to role play, completely different kind of setups for, you know, how you interact with each other and how you interact with the world. They're telling really interesting kind of stories, and often, you know, kind of stories from kind of marginalized creators that wouldn't necessarily find another outlet. And it's kind of great to see places like Itch.io and places like that kind of being kind of places where indie creators can kind of come together and get their work out there and kind of support each other. But I would love to see kind of some of that work get pushed into the mainstream.
Yeah.
I'd love people to kind of be exposed and to find out. There's a game where you can play Jane Austen adventures. There's a game where you can play Russian biplane bombers.
Some of those sound just ripe for...
I'm trying to think. There's ones, this Monster Hearts, where you can play monster teenagers. If you ever wanted to be a zombie teenager in an American kind of high school drama, there's a game for that. You know, there's all these kind of really just wild and wonderful games where they're just kind of taking people by the hand and just dragging them into different stories. I definitely love to see kind of some of those kind of push through into the mainstream and get a little bit of attention.
It's all kind of cool because things are all coming together. You know, if you ignore the hellscape that we're inhabiting in this 105th of March, you know, the whole thing that, you know, people can live broadcast from wherever they are to as many people, you know, you can have, you know, a few mates, or you can have thousands of people, you know, watching what, you know, what you're doing. And, you know, you can all get together remotely and you can do this thing. And it's perfect because, speaking personally, in a small town, it's like, you know, I know, but, you know, more or less, is everyone here from a small town, pretty much?
I'm from Salford, so not really.
It
just meshes into Manchester at some point. So,
yes, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There's even in Carlisle up here, there's a few places which they are, you know, part of Carlisle, but they're not.
Yeah.
It's just sort of, you know, spread out slightly. But yeah, Carlisle, minuscule in comparison. And yeah, it was always hellish trying to get people together to, you know, play tabletop. So you relied on your social circle.
Yeah.
And of course, now your social circle can be, you know, as big as, you know, your biggest retweet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, kind of for their part, I know Wizards of the Coast have done kind of, they do kind of organized play events.
Yeah.
This started under 4th edition, where it was really good. I tried doing it under 5th edition, and it was not quite as good. Mm-hmm. But there were, you know, it used to be, back when it started under 4th ed, there would be 5 of us sat around a table. Kind of the one time I went to our local gaming store for like a 5th edition night, and there was like 100 people in there.
Wow.
And that's kind of the transformation that we've kind of seen. It's just, it is really great and it's fantastic to see. But like I said, I want that kind of, that equity to be spread, mm-hmm. you know, across everybody. At the moment, because D&D is kind of that massive front runner, and because it is, you know, it's the one that Critical Role play, you know, it's the one that whatever Christopher Perkins' new show is called, it's what they play, it's what Acquisitions Incorporated play. That's the one that kind of people know, and so they all kind of gravitate towards it. As soon as you start introducing more games, it starts to fracture the player base. So, you know, it's probably never going to happen, but I would love to see them kind of branch out and, you know, get the opportunity to play these indie games.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to the popularity of, like, D&D and whatnot nowadays, how crucial do you think tools like D&D Beyond and, was it, Roll20 and things like that are to kind of grow in the base? Do you think it's... Because obviously it's made stuff easier for people to get into in certain respects. But, I mean, is that kind of one of the reasons why so many people are into it now? Do you reckon?
I think probably the cultural footprint's more of a factor than the kind of tools that they've got. D&D Beyond, whilst it's kind of useful for constructing characters, it doesn't really link to anything yet. They've only just kind of implemented dice rolling on the site. It, you know, I'm having to use a third-party extension to link it up to Roll20, so it doesn't quite do what you need it to yet. And kind of Roll20 itself has got its own problems. Kind of places like Astral and kind of the other competitors aren't quite there in terms of kind of their accessibility yet. So you really are kind of waiting for somebody to come along and make it just an easy one size fits all kind of solution. Mm. The other problem that you've got with Roll20 is kind of the PDF problem. Kind of a lot of RPG kind of creators, if you buy a physical copy of their book, you will get the PDF as well.
Can testify to that for Spire. Yes.
Yeah. Whereas for Wizards, the PDFs that you can get on D&D Beyond are actually a separate product from the physical books that you get. And there is no bundle option.
Yeah.
Which makes it makes it kind of a problem, because ideally what you'd really like is you'd like all the books that you've bought, you'd be able to get all the content out of that, use the kind of platform, and then you can construct characters out of like all the different splat books you've got together, or you can build encounters with all the monsters out of them. And at the moment, that just doesn't happen. And that kind of creates a bit of a barrier to entry, because, you know, if especially if kind of you've started playing before we entered Hellscape, 302nd of March, you know, before all this kicked off, you know, it was quite likely that if you played in person, you probably had a physical book, because...
Yeah, or at least knew somebody that
physical
had
book
one.
Is... Yeah, exactly. Whereas now you're kind of... If you've got that, but you want to play online, you either need to rebuy your stuff on D&D Beyond, or if you are very lucky like me, you have a friend who decided to buy all of his stuff on D&D Beyond, and he will actually link you up with their kind of account, and then you actually get access to their stuff, but only as long as you're in the same campaign.
Hmm.
So there's ways around it, but it doesn't feel like a system that's necessarily... as accessible as it needs to be a factor.
I think one advantage our gaming group's got is that every key household playing in it online has at least got the player's manual for 5th ed, except for my brother.
Yeah,
but then he's usually got fewer questions about stuff, and we kind of just have to help point him in the right direction.
Yeah,
anyway.
Your brother has, rather than kind of thinking about, like, ooh, it'll be interesting to play this type of character, or interesting to play this species or that class... your brother basically puts them into a random generator, and which is why we've got a Verdun monk for him.
But you know what? Interesting aside on that, so when we were helping him build his character for that, and we were using D&D Beyond's free stuff so that he could like help look at stuff, and he was like, oh, this looks weird. And then we went to the same, we navigated to the Verdun race listing at the time on the website, and it turned out something had genuinely gone wrong with D&D Beyond's like website, and I tweeted them like, going, guys, like, what the heck's going on? I sent a screenshot where we had basically, I think, almost like all the code for like their cookies just being put back to us rather than the actual page. And then over the course of the evening, whilst we were trying to help my brother build his character, I was like troubleshooting with D&D Beyond so they could get their site text, their debts, to fix whatever the heck had gone wrong. But now bringing this back to people buying stuff, my issue with using D&D Beyond to buy content is that, unlike the PDFs from the indie developers and that, if you've only got that digital content, and keep in mind the cost of it is actually more than like regular novels, or in some cases digital films and stuff, and obviously like music albums and that, it is tied to that service. When something inevitably happens to that service, they decide to, you know, like archive it in some way because it's become a legacy type thing, and they've got a new thing out inevitably that they want everyone to buy, because they haven't made any sign of saying like this, you know, 5th ed is the be all and end all. I mean, there's a chance it's going to be a 5.5 at some point, or obviously like a 6th ed. Like, what happens to all that content? There are no guarantees there that content is going to continue to be available, which people have spent almost the same amount as they would for physical copies. But they don't have physical copies, they've got digital copies, and that really concerns me.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's basically the problem with pretty much any digital platform. Yeah. And yeah, no, you're entirely right.
I mean, I suppose the issue with something like D&D, though, is unlike something like a digital game, which, depending on where you're getting your books from, I did slightly find my eyes watering the last time I was in Forbidden Planet in London, near the... which one was it? The one on the way to Soho. It was just like... It was wolf... sort of eye-watering. Like, you could buy a video game after one, not two books. But then at the same point, like, at least I've got the game, whereas with, like, books from D&D, like, okay, so once you've got your player's manual, your DM's guide, and then inevitably you're going to find you're going to want more than just those two books to play, because they don't have all the cool things, as it were. It suddenly starts to add up in terms of digital content, whereas the cost of those books, I could have bought by that point maybe 6 to 8 digital novels, if not more.
I mean, that is the thing with tabletop gaming, but I remember it was always the issue of the books were hugely expensive.
They continue to be hugely expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one constant, isn't it?
Yeah. Though, to be fair, I know I'm being slightly biased here because we've got JP on the show and I did buy it, but I found the pricing for Spire to be actually quite reasonable for getting the physical and digital copies. I was quite happy about it. So, you know, that was nice. I think before we go to some kind of conclusion, JP, where can people buy Spire, The City Must Fall and the one-shot collection Shadow Operations if they so desire?
Okay, you can buy Spire, The City Must Fall and Shadow Operations at RowanRookandDeckard.com. That's Deckard with just a C, not a K, because they're difficult. I will say Shadow Operations, 50% of the profits from that is going to Black Lives Matter UK. That's kind of, they've announced it this week. And basically that's all the profits from when it originally came out about a month ago.
Yes.
In perpetuity. So half of everything, the kind of all the profits that they're making off that, they're donating, which I thought was a really great gesture. I'm really kind of glad that I got to contribute to that. For me personally, if you do want to find me, you can find me on Twitter at DJPBradley, BRADLEY. Please say hello. Tell me that you listen to this so I know where you came from. I'd love to talk to you.
They're already outside your window right now.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
It's either that or it's his cat. I mean,
do you know what?
Maybe his cat wants to get in contact.
Getting on Twitter to tell me tuna, human.
So damn you and your monopoly on opposable thumbs.
We will make sure to include links to where you can find Spire and that on the notes for this episode if you didn't get the address. But it is... It's time to say, yeah, that is genuinely all we've got time for this episode. So it is good night from...
JP Bradley. You can find me on Twitter at TheJPBradley.
And it's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
It's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I'm on Twitter's at Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at EMKingMA. You can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can find us on Twitter at NerdsPodcast and Instagram at NerdsPodcast. We're also on Facebook as NerdsAssemble Podcast. Episodes are also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher, potentially Pocket Casts. I can't remember. Obviously, we are still looking to upgrade our website, and stuff is slowly happening behind the scenes in order to enable this. We will warn via the social medias when this is going to happen. So if you suddenly find in the coming weeks or months that stuff's suddenly not available, that would be why, because we're having to switch stuff over. But anyway, that's all we've got time for this week, so good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I think 2020 rolled a one.
Oh. So -1 for Christmas.